I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Soul School, Lesson 53. To get full advantage of this series, this short series on wisdom text from Ecclesiastes, go to Lesson 50 to find out what I'm doing and also get some background context, cultural context, and some language context for what I'm doing. I'm going to be reading today a few chapters in Ecclesiastes, which is sort of surprisingly secular that you might already know. And I'm reading from Dr. David A. Dorsey's translation, which has some more exacting meanings of text that you tend to find in most translations of the Bible. And I'm also going to be comparing in ways that you might have not saw before The Myth of Sisyphus by Albert Camus, going over some things that you might find similar in ways that you didn't realize before. And I'm in no way saying that King Solomon or whoever compiled Ecclesiastes is atheist in any way, but there's some characteristics there that are interesting to absorb and I think can bring more meaning and fulfillment to our lives and how we interact with others. So thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you'll go back also and listen, if you haven't already, to my conversation with Krista Tippett, which was such a joy to do. Go back and listen to that episode that was just put out a few days ago. What I'll do first is read some chapters in Ecclesiastes and speak about them and talk a little bit about the absurdity of suffering and how we are supposed to encounter it or what we can think about in suffering. Some of the pat answers that have come along in religion that I don't find very satisfying, and some of the answers that have come along in secular atheism that I don't find terribly satisfying either, but in some ways answer the problem a little bit better. And maybe there's some common middle ground that can be found that in a way almost embrace the two together. And this is just obviously my point of view. I'm still unsettled about where I stand on the point of suffering and so-called theodicy, or what is God's role in suffering, or how we are supposed to encounter suffering in light of God, or how are we supposed to understand it. So beginning with Ecclesiastes 6, this is headlined, Hypocrisy and Insincerity Before God. Be careful when you come to God's temple. Obedience is better than the sacrifices offered by fools. Fools are experts in wrongdoing. Do not be like them. Do not be glib in what you say to God, or be hasty in what you promise. Remember, God is in heaven and you are on earth, so let your words be few. The fool comes in with much fanfare, making insincere promises with many words. But when you make a vow to God, do not delay in keeping it. God is not pleased with fools, so fulfill your vows. It is better not to vow than to make a vow and not keep it. Do not let your mouth get you into trouble. Do not try to tell God that you didn't intend to make the vow. Why should God be angered at what you say and take away what you have achieved? So avoid empty promises and long, insincere speeches. Instead, respect God and submit to his authority. Greed and oppression of the poor. Do not be surprised when you see rich people in a particular district defrauding the poor or depriving the powerless of justice or due process. For influential men protect one another, and they in turn are protected by even more powerful men. And above all them is the king of the land and officials who serve him. The people who love money will never have enough of it, and those who love wealth will never be satisfied with what they have. Wealth cannot give a person lasting satisfaction. The more a person has, the more he needs. Rich people expend much energy watching and guarding their wealth. In contrast, the sleep of a common laborer is sweet, whether he has little or much to eat. But the riches of a wealthy person do not allow him to sleep. Miserliness. Another tragic thing in this world is when someone hoards his wealth rather than enjoying it, and then loses it all through some misfortune so that he does not have anything to leave his children. Just as that man came forth naked from his mother's womb, so he departs with absolutely nothing. He leaves as he came, with nothing to show for all his lifetime of labor. It is a tragedy. He departs this life with exactly what he had when he came into it, nothing. And what does he have to show for all his labor? All his wealth is gone like a vapor. And this is especially tragic since he did not even enjoy his life. He ate his food in gloom, with much unhappiness, misery, and displeasure. I saw clearly from this that a person should enjoy his life and his work during his few days God gives him, for this is God's gift to him. When God gives a person wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy these things and to accept what God has given him and to find joy in his work, this is truly a gift from God. Such a person will not be overly concerned about how long he lives, since God has filled his days with joy. Dissatisfaction with life, failure to enjoy what one is given. I have observed another tragedy in this world, and it's very common. Sometimes God lets a person have wealth, possessions, and honor so that he lacks nothing his heart desires, but then God does not grant him the ability to enjoy these things so that another person ends up enjoying them instead. Such a person seems to have much, but he actually has nothing. It is a great tragedy. Even if such a man has 100 children and lives, no matter how long he lives, if he is never satisfied and never enjoys the good things he has, then even though he is among the living, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he is. Even though a stillborn child arrives for only a moment and disappears into darkness where it is forgotten, never once seeing the sun or knowing anything at all, I say that this child experiences more tranquility than that man does. Even if the man lives 2,000 years without joy, both of them end up in the same place, the grave. All the man's efforts have been to accumulate things to enjoy, yet he is never satisfied with what he has. Conclusion: enjoy what God has given you. This is why the wise person is far better off than the fool. For the wise person has learned to enjoy what he has. It is far better for a person to enjoy what he has than to crave what he doesn't have, which is elusive and ethereal, like a breeze that cannot be held. God has already determined what a person should have and what a person should be. One cannot dispute with God over these things, for his authority is greater than that of human beings. People desire many things that ultimately are of no value to them. But how can a human even know what would be best for him in his life during the few fleeting days that he lives, like a passing shadow? How could he know what would be best for him in his future? Choosing the better things in life, some things are better than others. Remembering a deceased person's life is better than enjoying expensive perfume, and mourning a death is better than celebrating a birth. It is better to go home where there is mourning than to a home where there is merriment, because death is the destiny of every person, and those who are still alive should continually remind themselves of this. Sorrow is more valuable than merriment, because it can make you a better person. Therefore, wise people prefer funerals, and fools prefer parties. It is better to listen to a wise man's rebuke than a fool's flattery. Like the crackling nettles under a kettle, so is the praise of a fool. It may sound impressive, but it has no real substance. Flattery can make a wise person do something foolish, and gifts of influence can twist a person's reason. It is better to finish a task than to begin it. The patience that brings a task to completion is better than the enthusiasm that begins it. Do not be easily annoyed. It is a fool's heart that is full of vexation. Do not say, "Why were the old days so much better than these?" For such a question comes from a lack of wisdom. Wisdom is better than inheritance. It benefits a person throughout his life. The protection that wisdom gives is better than that of wealth. Understanding is exceedingly valuable, and wisdom gives life to the one who possesses it. Conclusion: enjoy the good times and accept the difficult times as also from God. Accept the fact that you cannot know what God is planning for you, since he has kept it hidden. When times are good, enjoy them. When times are bad, remember, God is responsible for the one as well as the other. You never know what will happen in this life. Advice for living wisely: avoid destructive perfectionism. During my brief life, I have seen both of these: a righteous man destroyed because of his righteousness, and a wicked man living long because of his wickedness. Do not demand of yourself perfect righteousness or perfect wisdom, because such perfection can destroy a person. On the other hand, do not abandon yourself to evil or folly. Why should you die before your time? So shun both perfectionism and wickedness. The man who respects and obeys God will find the pathway between these two evils. Such wisdom will give the wise person better protection than a walled city commanded by 10 rulers. Remember, there is no one on earth who is perfectly righteous, only one who only does what is right and never sins. So do not take to heart every word that people say. Do not listen too carefully when you overhear your servant saying something bad about you. For you know in your heart that you yourself have spoken ill of others many times. I evaluated all this with wisdom. I realized that even though I wanted to be perfectly wise, it was beyond me. It was beyond my reach and too deep for me to fathom. I investigated and explored the nature of wisdom and logic to discover why wickedness is foolish and why folly is irrational. I realized that this woman, folly, is more bitter than death. She is a snare. Her heart is a trap. Her hands are fetters. The man who pleases God will escape her, but the sinner will be ensnared by her. But regarding perfection, this is what I have found, says the teacher. After considering one thing after another, I realized I could not find what I was seeking. I have not found one perfectly righteous man among 1,000, nor have I found a perfectly righteous woman among them. What I found instead is this: God created mankind perfectly righteous and upright, but human beings have developed a multitude of ways to pervert God's good design. Who is the wise person who understands these things? Such understanding will brighten his face with joy. Now, I read chapter 8, verse 1, because it goes along with the rest, but I'll read subsequent chapters 8 and the following in later episodes, and we'll probably do maybe two more. And I'm going to go back a little bit and explain a couple of things. So, wisdom and folly are both personified as women to give the teaching more personification and gravitas. It's not a slight towards women or anything like that. It's just to kind of personify those things. Again, as I mentioned in other episodes, those words, evil, folly, wicked, righteous, are not religious words in wisdom text, in Jewish wisdom text. Righteous means the right path. Wickedness is the opposite of that, so the wrong path, the path in life. We're not talking about hellfire and damnation or heavenly realms where you go when you die or anything like that. We're just talking about wisdom for this life, pragmatic, practical wisdom for living and having a good life versus having a problematic and troubled life. It's important to know that even though we see these things in the Bible and we think it's about sinners and saints, even the word sin typically means missing the mark or taking the wrong path. And a sinner is a person who's taking, usually means the person is taking the wrong path. It's not a condemnation of the soul type of reference, as it's referencing this in wisdom literature. So it's easy now with our context of religiosity and to superimpose a modernist purview on these texts and think of it in really religious terms. But as we're reading it in the way in which it was meant to be read by the people who were reading it at the time, or not even reading it, listening, I'm just telling you the way it was meant to be heard. So it was meant for practical living. This is a teacher or a king giving wisdom to someone younger to try to avoid some of the pitfalls and problems life has to offer. And in terms of suffering, I wanted to talk a little bit about the unreasonableness and the irrationality of suffering and the futility of life for a minute. That isn't specifically what I covered in the text reading today, but it is a big piece of what Ecclesiastes is about. And when we talk about the meaning of life and all the suffering that is entailed with life, a lot of it can seem absurd. In secular circles and in atheism, sometimes people will even come to the sense that there is no God because of suffering itself, considering that suffering seems to have no purpose and there must either be a malevolent God or no God at all because of suffering itself. And then on the other side of the argument is that, well, God must have a reason for suffering, or that somehow suffering will work out for good. God will use it for our good. And there are different ways that this has been approached through the ages, and this is one of these age-old questions of what is the sense of suffering and what are we supposed to make of it? I think that those neat and tidy answers, on the one hand, are very unsatisfying. When you've suffered quite a bit, the neat and tidy answers and the Bible verses that all things work together for good are some of the least satisfying things you can hear. It's because you're in so much pain and so much anguish, they don't seem like sensible things to hear. Even if they're true, they're very difficult to believe in those moments. So Christians would say that God and God and Jesus and his work on the cross gives life meaning and smooths over all the suffering because Jesus suffered. But I think that, to be honest, there is some real terror in thinking, what if that isn't the case? And that anxiety will solidify those beliefs. And on the other hand, realizing that there's absurdity in life and thinking about that if life is truly meaningless and life is truly absurd, what is the sense in living? Suicide can become a very attractive option. And so what's left then but for all of us to just go and kill ourselves? So we need to come up with something hopeful to stay, right? I think that that then becomes another terrifying reality or option. And we know that that's not a good answer too, to throw ourselves into this intellectual abyss. This is kind of the curse of consciousness, that we get to contemplate our own existence in such depth and from such a few levels back, contemplate our contemplation of consciousness and existence. Not to get too deep into the deep side of the pool here, but I wanted to make a comparison with The Myth of Sisyphus by Albert Camus, 1942. In his work, he talks about, in Greek literature, he was condemned to roll a rock up a mountain every single day. Kind of in our modern times, we might think of Groundhog Day with Bill Murray. He's condemned for a while to live out the same day, day after day after day, until he learned some lesson. But in this Greek myth, Sisyphus is condemned to roll a boulder up a mountain. Every day he rolls it up, but every day it rolls back down again. And there's this futility that we sense in this myth that mirrors our own lives. There's a futility to life that every day we wake up and we do it all over again. But for what? In the end, we go to the grave. In the end, we leave everything that we've worked for and we don't get to keep it and take it with us. And it's for nothing, really. And our lives are short and ultimately futile. And so we have to consider, what are we doing this for? And Camus comes to the idea that all of this is completely absurd. Life is completely absurd. But that if you take joy in the struggle itself, if that's enough, and you imagine that Sisyphus is content or happy in his life as it is, then that's enough. Instead of seeing rolling the boulder up the mountain as a problem, you're not seeing it as a problem anymore, and that you can embrace the absurd. You can embrace life as whatever it is. But we tend to see the toil and the struggles as problematic and absurd and negative. We can bring some of that insight into Christian worldview and other worldviews as well. We will tend to see suffering and problems in real negative light instead of being able to embrace the absurdity. And from my standpoint, much suffering is without reason, absurd and needless. And while we can learn things from them somehow in the end, there's still a lot of tragedies and evilness and problems in the world that outweigh the goodness that can come from them and are very, very unreasonable. From our vantage point, they are very absurd. And we don't have to neatly package that into, but everything will work out in the end, and that should make you feel better. But we can still embrace the absurdity and realize that from our vantage point, there's a distortion. It doesn't mean we have to smooth it over with an easy answer. So I actually appreciate Camus' vantage point. I don't completely agree with it, but I see that there's actually some value in imagining that Sisyphus is content with his situation. In the end, suicide can't be a viable option because we are useful to others. Even if our bodies aren't useful, our encouragement might be useful, our words might be useful. People need us, and we need other people. It might not seem like it at the time, but our lives can matter because we can be helpful, and we are a species that relies on each other. When someone is lost because of death, there is a cascade effect that's negative, and so our lives make a difference in the world, even when we don't realize that they do. Another reason why people have a sense of hope despite the futility that we see in our world and the futility of existence that seems apparent sometimes is because they will find meaning and purpose in their lives and doing some good in the world. And I think that those are fantastic reasons to not feel like life is futile. But I do think that those are constructs. Those are things that we create to give ourselves a hope. But constructs are fine. I think we have to admit that they're constructs, but meaning and purpose and hope are great ideas, and they keep us going, and they make the world a better place. And because we are humans that rely on other people and make the world a better place together, creating constructs together is of utmost importance. And so on Soul School today, your homework is to see how your constructs to make the world a better place can somehow align with other people's constructs. So that means whether it's putting more kindness into the world or more peaceful dialogue or something like that, find out ways that you align with other people in friendship or in camaraderie. And when you see that the world seems futile or that you're pushing that boulder up the mountain again and again, day after day, which you are and we all are, that you realize that there is still joy in it. There's still contentment in it because you get to realize that you're pushing the boulder up the mountain. We have consciousness to realize what we're up to and what we're doing. One day we won't get to push the boulder up anymore. We'll be in the grave. And that's not meant to be depressing. It's meant to show you that your days are numbered because you can enjoy them right now. Whatever boulder you're pushing up, be grateful for whatever boulder that is. There's opportunities to be grateful for the very small things in your life that bring you joy. And so I ask that you would join me next week for more on Ecclesiastes, more wisdom text. And if you have suggestions or feedback or comments, you can leave them at the Facebook community page. It's just facebook.com/sparkmymuse. I'd love to hear your comments or suggestions. Or connect with me on Twitter at Lisa Delay, LisaDelay. I'm very grateful that you joined me today to hear this. Come back on Fridays for a guest interview. Thank you, and may you be blessed.